From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at a new book called Anti-Democratic and learn about the partisan politics impacting Wisconsinites. Then we'll learn about some of the dunes you can visit in and around Wisconsin.
These are about 300 feet tall. And of course, these are on Lake Superior instead of Lake Michigan. You don't see as many up there, though they do exist. And these are the granddaddies of them.
We'll hear from two musicians who are the first to participate in the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music's Fellowship in Teaching Artistry.
I thought it was very important to understand that these were students who did not have a music program to begin with, or they had a music program, but it was so inconsistent.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. The future of U.S. democracy has been a major theme in the 2024 presidential election. But according to a new book, the anti-democracy movement has been taking shape for decades and includes some of the biggest players in American politics. Anti-Democratic by David Daley explores how conservative political actors and judges have attempted to reshape American laws and policies and insulate themselves from public accountability. Daley joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers and explores how this movement began to take root in light after the Voting Rights Act was signed into law.
Really, to understand this book, you need to have a good understanding of voting rights and specifically the Voting Rights Act. What are some of the ways in which the Voting Rights Act ensured access to the ballot box for voters around the nation?
Well, really what it did was you had states across the South and localities that were making it extraordinarily difficult for Blacks to vote or register, all the way up to violence and killings. And the Civil Rights Acts of the 1950s, of 1960, attempted to fix this. And it took baby steps along the way, but it required folks who were bringing a challenge to these procedures in the South to file the litigation in the same districts that the issues were taking place. And this was no solution because the judges there were oftentimes segregationists. They were often allies with the sheriffs and the politicians there that had no interest in multiracial democracy. And so in a place like Dallas County, Alabama, in 1957, when the Civil Rights Act begins, you have 1% of Blacks registered to vote there. By the time that the Voting Rights Act is passed, you'd had 6, 7, 8 years of court victories, but it only brought the registration numbers from 1% up to 5%. So the process of trying to rectify these rules simply wasn't working. It took preclearance to really give muscle and teeth to the actual language of the Reconstruction Amendments and to try to get around this intentional, creative, and willful defiance of the Constitution and the Congress.
In some ways, it seems obvious that in a democracy, you would want people to be able to access the ballot box. And yet, there was pretty immediate pushback, of course, from these communities. But also in the years since, there has been a lot of pushback. Specifically, you look at a figure who many of us will know, Justice John Roberts. As a conservative, what made the Voting Rights Act an issue for him?
That's a great question. John Roberts grows up in Indiana, and at his confirmation hearings in 2005, he looked like he'd arrived out of Chief Justice Central Casting. He talked about his boyhood and farmland and silos stretching towards the horizon. But that's not exactly John Roberts's life's background. John Roberts certainly did grow up in Indiana, but he grew up in the Indiana that might as well be a wealthy enclave of Chicago. He grew up in one of the most segregated towns in America, a town that even after the United States banned discrimination in housing laws, was still advertising itself in brochures as a whites-only community. He attended the most privileged prep schools in these towns. He goes to Harvard Law School as a young conservative. He quickly is pulled into the Supreme Court chambers for a clerkship of Justice William Rehnquist, who had his own long racist history of trying to block voters. And then Roberts moves quickly into the Reagan Justice Department in the early 1980s. And the first thing that comes on his plate is the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, which was fairly bipartisan at the time. You had a Republican in the White House, you had Republican control of the U.S. Senate, and the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized. But the leading force against it was John Roberts, 27 years old, in the Justice Department, trying to make it more difficult to prove voting rights claims. I went back and found his memos, and he talks about it shouldn't be too easy to make a voting rights claim. And his allies in this fight in the U.S. Senate were the staunchest segregationists of the era, in Strom Thurmond and Jesse Helms. And so we think of Roberts, the image that he created, that the press has maintained for him, as this centrist jurist calling balls and strikes. Trimming voting rights and limiting the power and scope of the Voting Rights Act has been his life's work, first as a young man in Washington, and then when he moves to the U.S. Supreme Court.
How has that played out during his time on the U.S. Supreme Court? He's been now on the court for quite some time.
He has. Roberts becomes Chief Justice in 2005. And I would say that John Roberts, in many ways, is less the Chief Justice of the United States than he is the most successful Republican politician, perhaps of his generation, when it comes to achieving conservative and Republican policy aims. John Roberts has delivered on things that conservatives could have never won at the ballot box, whether we're talking about changing voting rights laws, whether we're talking about campaign finance or gun control or the regulatory state, the administrative state, certainly the recent decision on presidential immunity. All of these are decisions that the American public, large numbers, disapprove of. But certainly the lesson that the conservative legal movement and John Roberts and others learned, and in many ways, they learned it out of the Voting Rights Act fight in 82 that Roberts lost, was that you didn't need to have 51 senators and 218 members of the House if you could control 5 votes on the U.S. Supreme Court. Now they're able to control 6. And so in a handful of decisions that have really been deeply damaging and forever altered the state of our democracy, Roberts has tipped the scales towards the Republicans every step of the way. First in the Citizens United decision back in 2010, which opened up our elections to a flood of anonymous dark money from plutocrats and other billionaires and wealthy interests. Then in the Shelby County versus Holder decision from 2013, which effectively eviscerated preclearance, which had been the most effective arm of the Voting Rights Act. So many of the kinds of decisions that followed from state legislatures around the country would not have been possible had those laws had to have been pre-cleared by the Department of Justice. You had 2 decisions on partisan gerrymandering, the case out of Wisconsin, the Whitford case, and then the Common Cause versus Rucho case that effectively closed the courts to partisan gerrymandering claims. All of which have had the impact of taking the Voting Rights Act, tearing it in half and half again, and really draining it of its power and enabling all of these legislatures to go ahead and act in ways that majorities disapprove of. So in the Dobbs case, for example, that put an end to reproductive rights in so many parts of the country and overturned Roe versus Wade, the court could write that they were simply returning a contentious issue to the people and their elected representatives. when they knew full well that what they were really doing was returning that issue to state legislatures that they'd already rigged in one direction to achieve the policy aims that they could not achieve any other way. And the court knew this because they themselves had effectively greenlit those gerrymanders.
There were a couple of key cases that came out of Wisconsin that impacted national politics. You mentioned, of course, Gil v. Whitford. There was also Wisconsin Right to Life. And as these movements are kind of taking shape in different states throughout the nation, they are also taking shape here in Wisconsin. How have we seen kind of anti-democratic movements taking shape in the state of Wisconsin? You mentioned gerrymandering, but there's been actually quite a bit since 2011 as well.
You're absolutely right. I mean, in many ways, the state of Wisconsin has been ground zero for these anti-democratic measures and movements. Wisconsin is as close to a 50-50 state as there is in the nation. We see it in so many election results over the years. And yet there has been these measures to first gerrymander the state legislature, which has been deeply enduring. But what we've also seen in the state of Wisconsin, of course, would be in 2018 after Governor Evers is elected, movements by that gerrymandered legislature to restrict the power of the elected governor and the elected statewide officials, including the attorney general. What we have seen in Wisconsin has been some of the most expensive state Supreme Court races in the country because folks have realized that if there is any way to put an end to this, it would have to be by controlling the state's Supreme Court. And so there's been really intensely funded efforts on both sides to try and win control of the courts because it's been in many ways a proxy battle over a redistricting and democracy itself. You just had the big constitutional amendments, which have been the latest effort by the legislature to entrench additional power on its side. Those were defeated and defeated handily. But those efforts just keep coming. And in many ways, I'm sure it's got to be exhausting for the people of Wisconsin who simply would like to have a legislature that represents them and electoral politics that resembles a situation where the side with the most votes wins, you know, something crazy like that. It's been a long time since politics in the state of Wisconsin has been easy or simple or representative.
The constitutional amendments being voted against, of course, at the ballot box are interesting in part because in response to that, the Republican leader of the assembly, Robin Voss, made it clear he really wants to double down on this. This is something he would like to bring back to the people of Wisconsin. He thinks that despite the major electoral loss there, that this is something worth pursuing. And yet, in many ways, it does feel like we're getting to kind of the other side of this. As you mentioned, Wisconsin Supreme Court races have been incredibly competitive. They've also been incredibly consequential. And we saw that this past winter when the court decided to redraw the maps at the local level, the state legislative maps. What do you see as kind of the future of democracy in a state like Wisconsin, where it does seem as though we are likely to have a more representative government in the near future?
It's been a really long road, though, hasn't it? Wow. I mean, when you think of the gerrymander that followed the elections of 2010, that in many ways it has taken voters in Wisconsin 14 years to be on the verge of taking back a representative democracy in one of the proudest purple progressive states in the nation. And that has been a really long and difficult fight. You are going to have elections this fall that matter consequentially. I think it's entirely possible, right, that the side that wins the most votes might actually control Wisconsin's assembly instead of having a supermajority going the other way, even when that side wins fewer votes. But what looms on the other side of this, right, is another Supreme Court contest that could tip the balance next spring. And so fighting for a democracy in Wisconsin is a never-ending battle, and you're going to have to be eternally vigilant and showing up in every single election to express yourself, whether those elections are in November, whether they're in April and May, whether they're constitutional amendments called in August because folks think that fewer people will be paying attention. You have to be eternally vigilant in order to protect democracy in a state where there is an active element looking to subvert it.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect. We will see what the future holds.
Thank you, Joy. I appreciate it.
David Daley is the author of Anti-Democratic, Inside the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music's new fellowship that brings musicians into classrooms in Milwaukee. But first, we'll learn about dunes and tell you about some that you can visit in the area. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you make a list of all the different ecosystems in Wisconsin, it might take you a while to get to sand dunes, if you get there at all. After all, we're not exactly the Sahara or a vast oceanfront coastline. But Kevin Revelinsky is here to change perceptions. In his most recent Milwaukee Magazine article, he wrote all about the dunes of the Midwest, what exactly sand dunes are, how they got here, and where you can go see some for yourself. He joins Lake Effect Sam Woods to share more.
Let's start with your recommendations, starting all the way up on Michigan's Upper Peninsula at the Grand Sable Dunes. What's unique about these dunes?
Well, these are about 300 feet tall. And of course, these are on Lake Superior instead of Lake Michigan. You don't see as many up there, though they do exist. And these are the granddaddies of them. And it's part of Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore, actually. And it's about a 5-mile stretch of them. And they're perched dunes, so they got that added height. And when you look down from them, you can see what looks like the Caribbean, because all that sand gets under the Lake Superior waves. And when the sun catches them, it looks incredible. And you think, wow, have I gone to the tropical islands? Of course, if you put your foot in the water, that illusion is dispelled, let's say.
Continuing our tour east to Michigan's Lower Peninsula, we get to the next recommendation on your list, Sleeping Bear Dunes. And you mentioned in your article that Sleeping Bear Dunes is the star of Midwest dunes. What gives it this distinction in your mind?
It's certainly one of the most photogenic, and it also gets 1.5 million visitors each year. So, it's quite a large park. There's a scenic drive through the park, and there's observation platforms where you can get out of your car and look out over the sloping sand to Lake Michigan. And the tallest rise up over 450 feet. These are perch dunes in that case, but they're also shore dunes, and they're active. So the wind moves them each year. So they're gradually going somewhere.
So continuing our tour south to the Indiana dunes, just east of Chicagoland, what is special about these dunes?
Well, I think it's just the surprise that they're there. You come out of Chicago and now you come up against 25 miles of shoreline that is its own ecosystem. You've got dune complexes. A lot of them are stabilized dunes, meaning they've got plants growing on them, trees, what have you. And there's hiking, a lot of hiking there. And it's actually a state park and a national park. So they're kind of Siamese twins in that sense. The tallest of them, 120 feet, I believe. And then there's a dune challenge for the hikers. So about a 1.5-mile trail with sand and steps that gets you about 552 feet climbing up and down, vertical gain.
Yeah, vertical gain indeed. And I'm getting the sense that part of the appeal for these dunes is that, well, it's a really big, tall thing that I want to climb.
I think so. It's the challenge because it's also kind of strenuous to walk in sand, obviously, but also it's just you see something tall, you just want to climb it. As a kid, you want to climb the tree. Adults want to climb Mount Everest. You see a tall dune, you think, I can go straight up that thing, which might not necessarily be the case. They are, with the steep sand, it can be kind of challenging. So it's nice when they have actual trails or steps, or in the case of Sleeping Bear, you can actually drive up to the top along the back there and get out on the observation deck.
We'll end our tour at Kohler Andre State Park, just north of Milwaukee. And now, after this interview, I'm going to go visit these dunes with another Lake Effect producer, Jimmy Gutierrez. But before I go, what's special about Kohler Andre? What do I have to look forward to at this place?
Okay, it's special because, one, it's close. It's very beautiful and accessible, and they have a cord walk. So instead of getting your shoes full of sand, you get to walk on these pieces of wood among the dunes. And it makes for a really nice trail. The dunes there are only 10 to 20 feet tall at the tallest. And, it's an easy day trip and enjoyable for the kids. Some of the other parks, you're going to find are a lot taller and a little more work.
I mentioned I'll be headed up to Kohler Andre here after this interview. But before I go, what tips do you have for myself and other hikers of these dunes?
You're going to want to wear shoes. A lot of people think, well, it's like the beach, I'll just go barefoot. But especially in the hot sun in the summer, it's going to burn your feet. I mean, it gets pretty wicked up there. One of the park managers I spoke with recommend the athletic sandals. I don't personally have those. I just wear my regular shoes and deal with the sand removal later. But you're going to want to have sunscreen, obviously not a lot of shade on a bare dune, a hat, water. Heat stroke is something that they deal with at some of these places in the summer a lot. Sleeping Bear gets a lot of people that suffer from that. So you want to have water, and it's a lot hotter on the sand. And if you're swimming, Lake Michigan is infamous for rip tides, rip currents. I know up at Whitefish Dunes in Door County, that's an issue. You want to be aware of that hazard and know what to do if you happen to get into one. So
shoes, water, sunscreen. Got it. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect and for getting me ready for this trip to the dunes. I'm going to take your advice and go see what Kohler Andre is all about.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Now, Jimmy, I know you were saying before that you have seen all the Dune movies.
Seen them all.
All three.
All three of them.
And read the book.
I was a youngster back then, but...
Does this sound at all like the landscape that you were...
It does not,
about?
No. And that I've seen with my own eyes. For one, we have a lake, so we have a lot of water.
A body of water, yeah.
Huge natural resource there.
I don't see anything here about sandworms.
No
so
sandworms.
Might be different as well.
Lots of wildlife. Lots of conserved natural areas. Mm-hmm. So it also says this 135-acre state natural area protects the rare dune community and four threatened plants. It's one of over 300 natural areas that are preserved for education, research, and the benefit of future generations. How about that, considering future generations?
Look at us. Yeah, we're thinking of the kids here.
All right.
The dunes are for kids.
Dunes are for kids. You want to go check this out?
Yeah, let's do it. Dune boys.
Okay, this is lovely.
Yeah. You can see the diversity of the ecosystem here. Really, you can't see too much sand. There's a lot of grasses,
really,
some trees.
Not a single sandworm to be seen. Hello, fellow duners. How are we doing today?
Good.
They got it. They understood the assignment.
Yeah. I'm Phyllis McKenzie. I'm a naturalist here at Kohler Andre State Park.
All right, I think we just have a couple questions. One, so I've seen the movie Dune. And this does not look like dunes. What is a sand dune?
A sand dune is a compilation of sand that comes in from off the lake, okay. Or from areas that are inland. So in our case, we have sandy beaches. The wind blows the sand up into dunes. Plants or something else holds that sand in place. It becomes an obstacle or a barrier. Okay. So then the sand doesn't disappear. It continues to pile up. Eventually, plants will grow that continues to hold sand in place, so the dunes get bigger. And there are layers of dunes. And the further inland a dune is, the more stable it becomes, and more plants can get established there.
So you were talking about further inland, that the dunes are kind of more permanent, more stable, less probably affected by everything that's happening with the lake, or maybe I'm making that. Okay,
that's,
okay.
That's true.
Okay,
that's good.
Nailed that. But how much do the dunes closer to the shore change over time? Like, if you have like a favorite dune, you know, after 5-10 years, would it still be there, or would it change to a place where it's like unrecognizable? Like, how impacted are the dunes that are closer to the shore?
So the dunes closest to the shore are heavily impacted in the winter because our winter storms tend to be a little bit stronger off the lake. So the sands blow up or may disturb those dunes a little bit more. Okay. The dunes get more disturbed if people walk on them. Because if you bare the soil, many of the dunes have what is considered a soil crust. It's actually a kind of moss.
Okay.
And it's not super pretty. It's not like your fancy green moss that you see in the woods.
Yeah.
In a lot of places in the dunes, it looks like burnt carpet.
Okay.
It's extremely important in terms of holding the soil in place.
Mm.
But it can also be buried, so it can be under some sand now.
Okay.
So you may not see it, but if that gets broken through, then you have erosion.
So what I'm hearing is we should stay on the cordwalk.
That would be really good, yeah. Staying on the cordwalk or staying on the beach, but not on the dune.
Not on the dune, okay.
Yeah.
I was curious how old these dunes are. Like, how far back does this ecosystem go here?
So these dunes basically have formed since Lake Michigan took its most current form. Some, like, 16,000 years ago, we were under ice.
Okay, yes.
And the ice started to melt, the glaciers melted. But the first glacial lake basin was actually larger than the current Lake Michigan basin.
Mm.
And on the to the west on our property, on the Ancient Shores Trail, you actually come to what is kind of the leftover terrace from that larger lake basin.
Okay.
At some point, the lake levels dropped, the ice retreated,
right.
And so Lake Michigan took its more current form somewhere 12 to 14,000 years ago.
Okay.
And so these dunes have been forming ever since.
Is there anything that you ask visitors to pay attention to that they don't usually notice around the dunes?
That's a good question. What you may have noticed in a couple of places where you're walking is in those more stabilized dunes, we may actually have more non-native grasses, not always invasive, but like even bluegrass or other grasses, because everybody who walks here has the potential to bring in seeds on their shoes. And something to be aware of in the dunes, late summer we start seeing lots of really pretty purple flowers in our dunes. Unfortunately, those are virtually all invasive.
Oh, no.
Those are all spotted knapweed.
That did stand out as beautiful.
They're very pretty, and the bumblebees will actually go to them.
Yeah,
we even have pictures of rusty patch bumblebees on invasive species. So we'd like to have more natives, so we do ask that people don't take any seeds with them, don't move the plants around, and do watch what you're doing with your firewood, too.
Phyllis was great. All right, so here's my takeaway that you didn't ask for. Dunes and the ecosystem and everything that supports dunes for a sand dune to actually happen is quite incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And there are tons of things I've learned about. Well, actually, everything I've learned has been pretty much directly from Phyllis. But I have such an appreciation for the kinds of places and wildlife and habitats that exist in the state that I didn't know and had no idea before we took this little trek.
Yeah.
Thank you for making this happen.
Yeah, my takeaway, I like the ephemeral and ever-changing part of the dune, idea of the
you
dunes.
You relate to that.
Sure, I guess. Got to be. You know, you can, I like looking out at these hills and wondering what they would have looked like, you know, 5 years ago, 50 million years ago, however much, and then listening to the wind that is constantly blowing here, and listening to the thing that is changing those dunes, changing the shape of what I'm seeing, and just being there for that moment. I love that.
That was Lake Effect Sam Woods, Jimmy Gutierrez, and writer and author Kevin Revelinsky. Milwaukee students haven't always had regular access to music education, especially Black and Brown students. Milwaukee Public Schools has added dozens more music educators in recent years, but there are still gaps. The Wisconsin Conservatory of Music wants to help increase diversity in classical music education. It launched the Fellowship in Teaching Artistry, which brings classical musicians of color to Milwaukee to teach in classrooms. Clarinetist Mauricio Franco and pianist Mikhail Johnson are the first two fellows in the Milwaukee program. WUWM Eric Vaughn fellow Nadia Kelly speaks with them about their experiences in the classroom and representation in music. We'll hear first from Franco.
I started at 10 years old, which for clarinet players is pretty young. Before that, I had no musical background. I was from a non-musical family. After studying the clarinet, I was very hesitant to do my due diligence of practice and dedication, but throughout much of my schooling and essentially grade school career, I found myself more enamored with the instrument and wanting to pursue it as a career.
As for me, when I started, I was at the age of 4. I think that was when my mom discovered that I actually liked classical music. There's a particular TV station that would be playing it on a Sunday morning. And she was just like, I'm not interested in hearing it. So she changed it and I started to cry. So that was where she started to realize that I had an affinity for classical music. And she took piano lessons at the time to have me around the instrument. It was not until maybe age 10. I was basically playing the piano, but it was more by ear for a lot of my early part of my career. For a time, I did think about giving up on pursuing music as a career, and it was not until I got to my undergraduate when I was really in the thick of being a forensic scientist doing my minor in music that I had a teacher who convinced me that it was possible for music to become a long life career, and didn't look back since, so.
How has it been so far, the fellowship?
The fellowship has been really great. I think it's allowed me to have a community in which I'll be able to get help in refining or advancing my career in the realm of teaching, and also to find ways in which I can craft and curate what my career in terms of performing would want to look like. Furthermore, on the educational front, to have people who look like me be represented in real time to young children who for a very long time have been told from the media that classical music or mostly music in general are for white European or Eurocentric ideas. And very rarely do we get to engage with music of Africa and of the diaspora and be able to let them know that, hey, women composers, Black composers, Latinx composers, they all exist and they're thriving. And musicians like themselves are also making it big and making a huge impact on the world. And for them to have that inspiration come alive within them to let them know that's possible, that's also very, very wholesome and very much something that I look forward to engaging with and tapping to in even more outside of the fellowship.
Yes, I completely agree. And I feel like the fellowship has been absolutely amazing resource for us as young artists who are finding the next stepping stone in our career and then moving into creating the stability that I think everyone searches for over time. I think for myself, I've searched for that for a few years now, and having the financial aspect taken care of here and being able to utilize the resources in the city, it has definitely been an asset. And so far in the educational front, as Mikhail has so mentioned, it's been just amazing being able to represent an entire culture in simply educating the youth, especially for myself, in a language native to them. Most, if not all, of my teaching is done in Spanish. for students. And I feel like that resource has been invaluable to them and has also held a special place in their minds as a point of inspiration. And for me, has been very fulfilling knowing that I'm able to provide that experience for young children who have never been exposed to music outside of our courses as well.
What were your first few teaching assignments like when you first came here for this fellowship?
For the first few times, it took a minute for me to just take in what the environment was giving me. I just had to not go in and just be like, you know, I'm the teacher. And, you know, and that's, at one point that had to be established. But at the same time, I had to recognize that I am also a stranger to this, or we're all strangers getting to know our environments. The students are trying to get to know me. I'm trying to get to know the students. And so I thought it was very important to understand that these were students who did not have a music program to begin with, or they had a music program, but it was so inconsistent that they just basically gave up on the fact that it would ever return. Or it would be students who had musical, huge musical interests, but there was so many promises that weren't kept, as it were. So to be standing in the gap through the conservatory as a liaison to say, hey, I'm here, even though I don't know how long I will be here, but I am going to make sure that my impact to you would be so valuable and so significant that you will know what to look for in my absence. That's what I hope to spread while I'm here, for as long as I'm here.
To some of my students, I feel like it's been nice to feel valued even more so than some of the teachers that they do see constantly. My experience in Houston definitely has helped, but it's not to say that there aren't special cases here in Milwaukee. Again, with the language, I was never exposed to that in Houston. Usually kids were forced into ESL quite young, as I was myself. Not speaking English for quite some time through early grade school. And so being able to provide that as a resource has been great.
The fellowship started a little while ago in August. It's March now. Do you have any memorable experiences with kids? Like something that either you felt really spoke to the sort of impact that you wish to have, or just memorable for whatever reason?
To have people who used to want to just play for the sake of, you know, banging and creating chaos, being able to see something on the board and being able to read it and play with everyone and kind of feel this idea of community among their peers when they play together drums or instruments of that sort, and to realize how it sounds really good, just like the music we hear on our headphones. So I'll take the rhythms that are coming from the music that they hear every day, you know, dance hall, rap, R&B, hip hop. I never let them think that the music that they listen to every day is less than. Classical music is not the only thing that exists. Although I will say I do introduce them to the fact that there are composers that look like them, that have this kind of music, and they use music that's, you know, native to the land here, United States and beyond. I let them know that that too does exist, but it does not diminish the fact it's not high art versus low art. It's all art. And so being able to draw on the very music that they love so much and to have them saying that, hey, this is not happening in isolation. There's a reason why it sounds the way it does. And for them to make that connection, and they were like, whoa, I didn't even know that happened. You know, I didn't even know that existed, or I didn't even know that that was the instrument, when they started learning instruments and they're starting to hear it in their music and they're able to pick things out. That becomes very inspiring, and they're able to navigate even deeper with the world that they are already a part of.
Some students really behaviorally are just having a tough time at home. I think I had one student who started crying just doing drumming because he just felt like it was an experience that he never would have had at home or in school otherwise. And that has stuck with me for months now. Today at Townsend Street School, we went over Trombone Shorty, which is a trombonist who is from New Orleans, specifically from the neighborhood of Treme. He started out listening to his brother James play the trumpet, and he found himself trying to emulate as much as he could, and eventually came across a trombone and started as Trombone Shorty, being pulled on stage by Bo Diddley. His story really was just so inspirational in that this neighborhood, or really parts of New Orleans, like I myself, you know, lived in poverty. And it's really tough to find value in music as you look at the financial burden that comes with pursuing this career. Trombone Shorty has shown the students really that a great artist can come from anywhere. No matter your background, no matter what you're surrounded by, you can always persevere and find yourself on a path towards fulfillment in something like music.
Mikhail Johnson and Mauricio Franco are the first two fellows in the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music's Fellowship in Teaching Artistry program. They spoke with WUWM Eric Vaughn fellow Nadia Kelly earlier this year. You can learn more about the fellows at wuwm.com. We'll take one more break and then learn about some of the secrets of Milwaukee. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Every Milwaukeean has their favorite fun facts about the city, something no one else seems to know. Now, a new book has gathered dozens of those stories into one collection. Secret Milwaukee by Jim Nelson is full of fun, lesser-known stories about the Cream City, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share a few of them.
There are a lot of stories in here that I think some like diehard Milwaukee history people are going to go, oh, yeah, I know this and right. That story. But what are the stories that you found as you were doing this that you went, oh, I didn't know about that. Oh, this is interesting.
Well, I'd have to say the biggest one for me, I don't know where I'd been, but the treasure of Byron Price. So there's a total of 84 locations in the book. That number was given to me by the publisher. And I had a good 75 to 80 ideas, you know, that I was working on, but I needed like those last few. And so I decided to crowdsource it using Facebook. So I put something out and said like, hey, is there something you'd like to know more about? Something strange, weird, or obscure? And a friend of mine told me to look into this and said that she and her family are just like obsessed with trying to find this treasure, this buried treasure somewhere in Milwaukee. I've lived here my whole life. I had never heard of this. I researched it. Had a blast looking into this, was going all over Lake Park trying to find not this treasure, but so much just like, can I find the trail that leads to the treasure would be nice. So that one was a lot of fun to write.
Of the stories that you wrote about, of course, we're not going to get to 70 or 80 of them. We're going to talk about just a couple here. But what are some of the ones that you find really interesting that I guess maybe you're surprised people don't know about?
One of the more surprising concepts, I would say, is cemetery history. And that actually bubbles up in a couple of the stories that I wrote into the book. Because once a cemetery is a cemetery, it's kind of hard to move it. Like, it can be done, but it's not done frequently. And when it is done, it's always controversial, like relocating graves and that sort of thing. And so What's happened is as the city and its suburbs have grown and they have taken over formerly rural lands, they now kind of surround some of these old closed cemeteries. And one of the things that's very interesting is they're just kind of hidden in plain sight. Like, you may drive past them, but you don't know that they're there. And oftentimes by design, because the city or the suburbs don't want people kind of trespassing on this cemetery land. And so they've deliberately not marked them. And I know there's one near Levy Cemetery near where I've lived most of my life. I had absolutely no idea it was there. And I started to do some research and I found the old cemetery and got onto the land. And sure enough, there are a couple of graves there and probably a few dozen unmarked graves as well.
Interesting. Now, this is kind of cemetery adjacent, but a story that I learned pretty recently that I know you talk about in your book is Milwaukee's interesting relationship to the origin story of The Exorcist. Now, can you dig into that a little bit?
Yeah, it's true. So there were three priests who were involved in the actual real exorcist. And there's this young boy who was believed to be possessed by the devil. He had grown up in a Lutheran family. Supposedly, an aunt of his introduced him to a Ouija board. And that's, according to the family legend, is what started it all. And when the parents became very concerned because of, like, flying objects and that sort of thing in their home, as one would become concerned. And they initially went to their Lutheran pastor, who evaluated him and said, you're going to need an exorcism, and that means you need to go to the Catholic Church. And apparently the boy was evaluated by a psychologist as well as a parapsychologist who specialized in phenomena of the paranormal, and everyone agreed. It took a while, but they were finally able to find a priest who was able to do it. And he was assisted by two younger priests who needed to hold the boy down. And one of those two younger priests later went on to become a professor at Marquette University and lived here for decades until his retirement. Did not talk about it very often in his experiences with that. And he is interred at Calvary Cemetery right here in Milwaukee.
Yeah. It's an interesting just little nugget of history. And I think this book is really just full of these nuggets of history, as it were. What would you say is your favorite bit of history that you put into this book?
You know, I have so many, it's hard to choose. I think one of the stories that I was very just fascinated by was the story of Dirty Helen Crommell. And her book has actually her autobiography has recently been re-released. And it's the story of the most notorious brothel keeper in Milwaukee during Prohibition. Now, for most of the stories in the book, for almost all of them, there's a site that you can actually go to do some touring. So, you know, obviously you can go to a cemetery, that's free, and you can go to some of these historic buildings, and either for nothing or very low cost, you can gain admission and take a look around. But the Sunflower Inn, which Helen managed during Prohibition, it's gone. You know, it's just a parking lot. I actually went to the parking lot and just to kind of reconnect, and I took a picture, ended up not putting it in the book. But her life story, which I'm not going to reveal in this interview because I want you to buy the book, but her life story is just so compelling. How she arrived in Milwaukee, the things that she did here, how she ended up living out her final days, that even though you can't visit the Sunflower Inn, I had to put it in the book anyway. It's such a great story.
Now, most of these are places that you can visit. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
What do you hope people take away from this book? Do you hope that they go on kind of an adventure of Milwaukee? Do you hope they just learn a little bit more about their hometown?
I'd really like to see that a lot. I think that the more we can connect people to places in the community, places they haven't been before, it just helps everyone develop a sense of identity. And when you develop a sense of identity that is Milwaukee-based, you tend to care more about the city itself, as well as the people who inhabit the city. So, you know, sort of one of my big goals is to try to like bring people together. But in the meantime, just get out, get to know your city. Each site, each story is only 2 pages long, so it's very digestible. It's easy to read. Find something that you like. Find something that you didn't know that was there. Go visit that too. And then if you like it, hang around for a while. Have dinner at one of the neighborhood restaurants. Talk to some of the locals in the neighborhood or read up some more in one of my other books, perhaps, or go online and find something else that you can read about that neighborhood, about that site, about the people who live there, and kind of see this book as an entryway to greater learning.
All right. Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Jim Nelson is the author of Secret Milwaukee, as well as many other books about the region. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, X-Grit Nunez, and Dune Boys, Sam Woods, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Susan Bentz, Chuck Kornbach, Taryn Powell, Eddie Morales, and Eric Vaughn fellow Nadia Kelly from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reeve is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarra-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon to hear from a Wisconsin judge who attended one of the first desegregated schools in the country. We'll also tell you about the Milwaukee Road and how the company encouraged tourism to national parks out west. Thanks so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.